Hello there, it's Antrice, and welcome to another episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast. This episode is sponsored by Trakel Art Supplies, and Trakel is offering Savvy Painter listeners an exclusive gift from now through June 22nd when you go to trakel.com, that's T-R-E-K-E-L-L.com, and use promo code SAVVYGIFT, you get a Trakel gift pack. For over 30 years, Trakel has been obsessed with the art of brush making, and now they are applying that same obsession to professional grade panels and floating frames. They make everything right here in California at their Hesperia factory. Nancy Gruskin is a painter who lives and works in Concord, Massachusetts. She paints the people and things she is surrounded by on a daily basis. Her family, friends, objects, patterns and interiors of her house. Nancy has a PhD in art history, and if that is not enough, she's also a lawyer. So we talk about her path to becoming a painter and what role those past experiences play in her work. Earlier this year, Nancy's painting was included in an exhibition called Honoring the Legacy of David Park at Santa Clara University. So Nancy and I talk about her process creating the piece that was in that show and what it was like to be juried into the exhibition. Here is Nancy Gruskin. So Nancy, thank you so much for being on the Savvy Painter Podcast. I really appreciate the chance to talk with you.
Thanks very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Can you tell me a little bit about when you started out as an artist? Like, give me sort of a background story, more specifically about when you decided that this was going to be your vocation and that you were going to do this for real, I guess, is what people say.
Yeah, I definitely had a very curvy path leading this way. I've always painted and drawn. I took, you know, art lessons as a kid. We had a local museum in my hometown that used to have these weekend art classes, and you would draw and paint and sculpt. So it's always been there. And when I went to college, I went to Connecticut College, and I was a studio art minor. But my sophomore year, I took an intro to art history class, and I just fell in love with art history. And it was a very dynamic professor, and I just thought, I have to major in art history. So I did that, and right after college, I ended up going to graduate school for art, and specifically architectural history. So I came to Boston, I went to BU, and I was still, you know, sort of painting and drawing as a hobby, but I was studying to get a PhD in art history with the plan of teaching.
A PhD, wow.
Yeah. I didn't get enough of it in college. And I liked the idea of teaching. And I think it had to do with my professors at Conn, too, were, you know, just very dynamic and had such a clear passion for art and architecture. So I started down this path, focusing on the history of art rather than actually painting. And so I finished my PhD at BU and started teaching mostly architecture, modern and American architectural history. And I sort of did, you know, the rounds doing, I did a replacement position 1 year for a professor who was on sabbatical. I sort of pieced together part-time adjunct work. I did that for a few years, and it just became increasingly clear that the world of academia did not have enough tenure track jobs. So I started scrambling around thinking what else I could do. And the path gets even more twisted at this point. I come from a long line of lawyers. So on a whim,
I noticed that you had a degree, another degree. Okay.
I do. I love school. I really, you know, I'd go and get an MFA too if I felt like I could. But I've spent a lot of years in school already. So I took the LSATs, and long story short, I ended up going to law school at night in downtown Boston while I was teaching art history during the day. And at that point, I wasn't really painting at all. Things just got way too complicated.
Right. I'd imagine that's quite, that's very ambitious.
Yeah, well, as I said, I've always liked school.
I do. I mean, but I do too. Like, I think that if you could wave a magic wand, like, and just say, like, you know, time and money is not an issue, I'd probably have like 20 degrees also, because it's fun.
It is fun. And I get really inspired by people who are passionate about what they do. And it doesn't really matter what it is. If they're showing a passion for it, that inspires me. So, I had a lot of great law professors. And so after I graduated, I did, which is going to sound completely unrelated, but it's about as close to academia as you can get in the law. I did appellate work. I was a law clerk, but then I opened up a solo practice, and I did criminal appeals for indigent criminal defendants.
What is an indigent criminal defendant?
An indigent criminal defendant is someone who has been convicted in a criminal court, whether it's state or federal, and they have been deemed worthy of free legal counsel.
Okay.
So I have a license to practice here in Massachusetts and in Connecticut. And so the court would appoint me, or I would go through the public defender's office and get cases that way. And in Massachusetts, you have an automatic right to appeal any criminal convictions. So then the case would land on my desk. And it's very much in keeping with kind of an academic mindset, because you at that point, you're studying the transcript of the trial and really spending a lot of time in the library figuring out what are the arguments that you can make on appeal. So it's a lot of research and writing, which is similar to what you do as an art history professor. So it sounds completely off in left field, but
it sounds fascinating, actually. But
it is fascinating. And, constitutional law is definitely fascinating. But I was doing that for a number of years, and my husband and I had a child. And so I was primary caregiver for my son. And I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I just got to this point where I started to paint a little bit again on my own. And I was so much more happy when I was painting. I just felt like, and I think it was just due to my age too, I felt like it was time to make a choice. And, I talked it over with my husband and said, I just don't want to practice law anymore. And I don't want to teach art history. I just want to paint. And so that is a very long way of getting back to where I was in kindergarten, doing what I really love.
Oh, that's a great story.
It's crazy.
Crazy, I think most of our lives are crazy. I don't think many go in as direct a line as we would assume.
Yeah, that's probably true. And there's a kind of a common thread. I seem to be drawn to things that I can do on my own and allow a little bit of creativity. Mm-hmm. I've never really worked in an office, with lots of people and a hierarchy. And
you've got that independent streak in you.
Yeah, I think so.
So once you made that decision, how did you go about it? What did you do?
Well, it sort of took me a few months to kind of figure out. I felt like I had to figure out a plan, a sort of longer term plan, that if I was really going to do this, I was never going to send my son to college on the money I made from criminal defense work. But in switching to art, I felt like I had to, at least have some income coming in to make it feel like it wasn't just a hobby, that this was actually going to be a vocation. Mm-hmm. So, as is often the case, I think one thing sort of led to another. And I have connections with a local art association here in Concord. They have exhibits and also a whole series of classes and workshops. And I was exhibiting in one of their member shows, and that led to them asking me to do a demo one day, a gouache demonstration. And then, from that led to suddenly they wanted me to teach. And so I started to get these sort of commitments that made me feel like I was actually a little bit legitimate. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of snowballed from there.
Well, those commitments also, it's one thing, I think, to be painting in your studio and focusing on your own work. But even that small thing of doing it, I don't know how you feel about it, but I think a lot of people feel like it's both small and big to be asked to do a demo at a community arts organization. But the wonderful thing about it is it sort of forces you to think about and verbalize your ideas about art. And you're not often required to do that in your own studio.
Yeah, I think that's true. And in many ways, it's almost a separate skill, that there's the ability to paint, and then there's the ability to talk about painting. And
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know, you know, I think we all know painters that we've had maybe as professors who were fantastic painters, but maybe lesser teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, there are people who maybe their work isn't particularly suited to your aesthetic, but they're amazing teachers and you get so much from them.
Speaking of that, how has your background with art history formed your opinions or helped you? Has it helped you talk about your work, or how does that play into your studio life?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's really helped in terms of developing my eye. I spent so many years looking at paintings that I think I have a pretty good eye, which I guess can be a good thing and a bad thing. You can also, you know, look at what's on your own easel and say, forget it.
Right.
I can't do it as well. So why am I even trying?
I'm going to come back to that question. So hold that in your brain because.
Okay.
But go on.
But I think it does help train your eye. It's interesting the differences too. I mean, I've thought a lot about when I look at paintings as an art historian, the questions I asked were very different than the questions I ask now as a painter.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah. Well, so I went to see the Matisse Diebenkorn show in Maryland. Did you see it?
I haven't seen it yet. And I know it closes here in California at the end of this month, and I'm scheming how to get there.
Yeah, it's really good. Two heroes, yes, I'm sure they are for everyone. But, you know, when I, as an art historian, I thought the exhibition was fantastic and I've read the catalog and I think that's great too. As an artist, I want to know what colors were on their palette and did they tone a canvas before they started painting? And did they sketch in pencil and then switch to paint? You know, all the little technical details that come up when you're in your own studio. Where as an art historian, you know, I was very much taught by social art historians. So my approach to art history has always been, well, the paintings reflect their particular social place and time, and maybe, you know, what was going on in the artist's life and what was going on in politics, this kind of contextual approach. And as an artist, I just want to know the technical mm-hmm. details. And it's rare that you get art history that kind of covers that side of things as well.
Yeah, it is. So when you said that some of your thoughts were, why should I even paint? Because there's already so many great artists out there. I actually get that question a lot from people who are really frustrated, you know, are kind of at that point. It's often from people who are at that point where they have been away from art in much the same way that you were and then have come back to it. And then there's this sort of this question comes up, but there's so many amazing artists out there. What do I have to contribute? And I'm curious what are your thoughts on that now as you've kind of worked through it? It sounds like a little bit at least.
Yeah. I don't know. I think we're all kind of maybe painting the same thing. You're not going to reinvent the wheel, right? Or at least I'm not. I'm not going to come up with a new genre of painting. But I feel like, and maybe this is partially because I've come at this kind of later in life, that I have a bit of an experience, you know, I have a voice, I have something to say, that maybe it's the same. You know, there are plenty of painters I can list all day, painters who paint their dining room table and what's going on at home. But it's not what's going on in my house. You know, I have things, I think, as we all do, that are unique to our own lives. So when you tend to paint autobiographically, which I tend to do, I feel like there's usually something new to say, hopefully, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that fully addresses the question, but.
Well, I agree. I mean, it's interesting because I thought that way at one point, just thinking, you know, like, why bother? I'm never going to be Rembrandt, or I'm never going to be Picasso, or, you know, any of these great artists. But none of them did that to become Rembrandt, the icon, or Picasso, the icon. They pursued their art for completely different reasons. And so I kind of came to term with that piece of it that way. But I remember this was years and years and years ago. I was living in Los Angeles and I used to go down and paint the Los Angeles River. And for people who aren't familiar with the Los Angeles River, it is stereotypically Los Angeles because they paved it. And so it's kind of this wash, you know, with bridges over it that runs through the middle of LA. And most people don't even realize it is a river. And I was painting, you know, going through and painting bridges, and somebody made some comment like, oh God, everybody paints the bridges. Why would you paint the bridges? You know, like, you know, and they were sort of in their own way, kind of asking that question of why would you do this? Everyone's already done it. And I was like, well, right. I haven't done it yet. And
yeah.
And the person, I think, thought that I was a little bit arrogant, I guess, for saying that. But it wasn't meant to be like, well, nobody has done it yet because I haven't done it.
Right.
It was more like, I haven't explored this yet. And I have something to, you know, I might have something to say about it. And I think it's kind of like, to me, it's kind of like, you can take that to an extreme. Like, if you want to try to put it into perspective, and I hope it doesn't sound, you know, too arrogant for people who are listening, but this is going to sound so weird, but everybody in this world has talked so much. There's what could anyone possibly say that is so unique and original? And yet, through our own experiences and through our own life and through, you know, like, we each have our own perspective. And so it ends up that we do have something unique to say. So you could make the argument too that why bother talking, or why bother reading a book, or why bother writing a book?
Yeah, I agree. I was just going to say the same thing about literature or movies. You know, the basic stories have all been told, but there's always something, some new angle or some new perspective, and, you know, and people who feel like they just have to do it.
Yeah.
Whether it's going to end up in a museum or not, it's just something you kind of have to do.
Yeah. I'm interested in that question because it seems to be coming up a lot. So I'm making it a point to ask other artists what their perspective is on that, so that conversation can start to happen, that, you know, this idea that all the paintings have already been done, you could look at that and say, no, they haven't, because you haven't done it. Or yes, they have. And so what? You know,
yeah,
or.
Yeah. And also too, I don't know if you find this, but I, you know, if I'm on Instagram or Facebook and I'm just kind of scrolling through images, and, you know, particularly on Instagram, you can kind of, you know, your finger's going at a fast pace. You're trying to get through all the images, but then all of a sudden you'll just stop at one.
Yeah.
That will just kind of take your breath away. And you just think, I've never seen that before. And it might be a landscape. You've seen millions of landscapes, or it might be, you know, a portrait, but there's just something about it that it's definitely new. So I just feel like there's infinite possibilities. It seems to give up just doesn't seem like the right answer.
Right, right. You were in a show this year. Okay, so this is a side note, because we never know, like, this is actually going to come out in a couple months. So I know the show, I think, is still open as we're speaking, but I think by the time this comes out, it won't be. But you're in a show at Santa Clara. It is a group show with a bunch of artists who are sort of doing their own visual commentary on David Park. Is that correct? Do I have the details right?
Yeah, you do.
Can you tell me about that show and what it was like for you to be in it?
Yeah, it was really thrilling because, well, first of all, I love David Park's work, and talk about autobiographical. He's somebody who painted the people he knew and the places he knew. And that's always fascinated me. And I'm drawn to his work for that reason. That's a show, again, you know, I learned about it first on Facebook. I saw a post, I think it maybe have been John Seed's Facebook page. He was putting out the invitation for entries. They invited Kyle Staver and Jennifer Paczynski, who are the featured artists for the show. And then they opened it up to a juried exhibition to complete the show.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I thought, well, I have to apply for this, but to be honest, and I don't know, this sounds like false modesty, but I never thought that I would get into the show. You know, you know how these things are. You pay your $35 and you send your JPEGs and you think, okay, that was good. And I'll make a note of it to deduct it on my taxes for next year. But lo and behold, I got in, and I was so thrilled because, you know, if there's one one type of show that I would want to be associated with. It's that, you know, figurative painters who are painting about their lives. So I was thrilling. And, you know, some of my favorite painters are in the show. Unfortunately, I didn't get out to California to the opening or to be able to see it, but there's a lovely catalog and I've seen lots of pictures online and I'm really proud to be a part of it.
It's beautiful. I did not get to see it either in person, but I think that's sort of the beauty of being Instagram or Facebook friends with so many of the people who are directly involved in it. Is it, in some weird way, it sort of felt like I was there. Like I was so excited when it opened and I started seeing pictures. I'm like, oh yes, this is fantastic.
I know. It would have been great to be there. I saw that David Park's daughter spoke, and so it would have been nice. But yeah, you do. It's nice. You get to feel like you're there. I've seen videos, and I even get the sense of scale of the paintings that are in the show, and so that part's nice.
So cool. Can you tell me a little bit about? I think this is a question most like everybody. A lot, I shouldn't say everybody, but a lot of artists struggle with when they're starting out is you kind of look at like, okay, I'm going to do this. I know I want to paint. And there is a feeling that there needs to be some legitimacy or some sort of validation of you and as an artist and your work itself. I'd love to hear, because you kind of, you know, mentioned that was a thought that you were having. I'm curious how you tackled it. I have a suspicion, like from your background, that you may have tackled it a little bit differently than a lot of people do. And I might be stereotyping you and making a huge assumption because I just have this like idea that you have this art historian perspective and then you also have this lawyer background, which requires you to be probably a little bit more organized than most artists are. And again, I could totally be stereotyping, but I'm curious if that's true. So I'd love to hear what you were thinking and what you did.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Well, I think that's why the teaching helped. I feel like if students feel like they're getting something out of it, then that is validating and legitimizing, you know, even when the work's not selling, if there are people who seem to be getting something out of a class with me, or that just, I don't know. And maybe that's from my academic background, but that felt really good and very validating. And in terms of, I guess I was looking for the kind of structure that provides too. Because it is, you know, I paint out of a studio in my house. It's this little tiny 11 foot by 11 foot room that used to be my law office. It is now my painting studio. And you know, it's very easy to feel like it's just hobby when you're working at home.
Did you set up deadlines for yourself, or was it the kind of consistency of going in and doing those classes at the community center?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of doing the classes. You know, I try to set some long-term goals, even if I don't say them out loud or write them down. I try to think about where I want to exhibit. And, you know, I don't have, unfortunately, I wish I had more answers than questions. I mean, I'm not currently represented by a gallery, and that whole piece of it is something that I don't know. We need the galleries for validation. And yet, technology being what it is, we don't really need galleries anymore. So, you know, I'm fascinated by somebody like Mitchell Johnson, who I know you've had on the program, who has carved out this way of doing things that is not the traditional artist gallery.
Yeah.
And, you know, been incredibly successful doing that. So I don't know, the validation part is it's hard as artists. And maybe, I don't know, social media makes it maybe both easier and more difficult, because you put things out there and you don't really want to admit that you're looking for likes, but of course you're looking for likes and positive comments, you know?
Yeah.
Or you wouldn't be on it at all. So I'm rambling here, but
I mean, it's an honest assessment of what's out there and what your thoughts are on it. I mean, the whole, like I've said this many times on the podcast, that we live in this place, we live in this time, I should say, where we have direct access to collectors and we can reach people. It's another tool, I think. And I think there's a lot of, so I look at galleries also as a tool. And we have all these different, we have so many tools at our disposal right now. And it's sort of up to us to decide which ones we want to use. And I'm not really sure that any one is better than the other. I think they all have their advantages and disadvantages. And I would say about the galleries that the piece that they bring is that it's sort of an outside voice, I guess, or the fact that that there is a distance between the artist and the collector, and that distance being filled by the gallery can be good in the sense that from a collector's point of view, when they're not sure about an artist or they're not sure about something, the gallery can serve as sort of an outside opinion for that, or a validation that, you know, that, okay, I think this artist is good and they're in this gallery. So that is my third party validation that someone else thinks that too, or they wouldn't be in the gallery. And then also, they have such a different exposure and reach than artists do by themselves. And so there's a lot of cross-pollination. And whether or not that's absolutely necessary depends on the artist, and it depends on your situation. Like, I think that the frustrating thing is that the answer as to which tool people should be using, I think, is usually, it depends.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. And I guess at the end of the day, I think you have to be open to any and all avenues.
Absolutely.
And it is funny how one thing leads to another.
Yes.
I really have found that everything that has happened since I started doing this full time basically has stemmed from something that happened previously, you know, whether it's a show and then a curator happens to see a painting of yours, and that, you know, I've had one painting in a show and then a curator came to see it and suddenly that developed into another show.
Yeah.
And, you know, one teaching job leads to another. So these things do snowball, which is very nice when it works out.
Yep. So I'm sorry, I did not mean to interrupt you on that one. I hope I didn't.
No, I think you rescued me.
I didn't want to interrupt your thought if you were going somewhere. I'm sure you were going somewhere with that. So I hope I didn't disrupt you. So you mentioned earlier that you love to hear how, you know, as an artist, you love to hear how other people start their work and how they work. And we all love that. So can you talk about how you start a painting? What are some of the first things you do when you go into your studio?
Sure. I usually have an idea of what I want to paint, and it could be something seen either on the dining room table. Like, I, you know, I do a lot of paintings of what's going on the dining room table, maybe as a way of avoiding actually cleaning up the dining room table.
No, I'm not doing the dishes. We're painting.
Exactly.
Right now.
I'm painting them. That's why, you know, people ask me why I always paint breakfast scenes, is because that's when I have the time to paint. You know, everybody's left the house and I get the remains of the meal. So it could be something like that that just strikes me. Or sometimes the painting that was in the David Park show, it's primarily my son tying his cleats for soccer practice. And he just went down on one knee to tie his shoe. And I thought, I love that pose. It's like this, I don't know, it looked like a classical, you know, late Roman sculpture or something. So I had my phone and I'll just take a quick photo of it. And that's pretty much the kernel of the idea. All I know is that I want to have a painting and he's going to be tying his shoe in it. And so I'll take that into the studio, and I don't tend to do a lot of studies or preparatory drawings because, I don't know, I feel like the idea kind of loses its inspiration for me if I do that.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Uh-huh.
Like, if I've worked it out that much, then it's done. I need to move on and get a new idea.
Uh-huh.
So I'll maybe, you know, I'm thinking about that painting in particular. I think I sketched him in. And I usually sketch I like to work on panels, and I usually sketch with either a pencil or like a China marker, those sort of grease pencils to get a heavier line. And I remember putting him in and then thinking, what am I going to do now? What's the rest of the painting about?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I usually find that inspiration around the house too. So I worked sort of from the camera for the, from the photograph for the pose. And then being at home, I can move my easel around. I brought it down to the dining room and I started sketching the dining room table. And sometimes then, you know, there's certain objects in the house that I've painted so often that I don't even need them in front of me anymore. So I think the rest of it was sort of improvised from memory.
What are some examples of those objects? Just out of curiosity.
There is one that will be familiar to anyone who's looked at my work. I have what I call the face vase. And it is this amazing vase that I bought on Etsy from an Australian ceramicist. Her first name is Vanessa. And of course, I'm blanking on her last name. But she sells them on Etsy and they sell out the minute she puts them on.
Oh, wow.
There's always this incredible, yeah, flurry of activity. And I saw one actually in a John Boker painting. He's an Australian painter that I follow on Facebook and Instagram. And I remember asking him about the vase because I thought it was just amazing. I'm kind of a sucker for anything with a face on it. So I went on 1 month and got one of her vases. And it's always on my dining room table. And I have a thing for flowers. It's always full of tulips or whatever they have at Trader Joe's at the moment. And so that ends up in paintings. And I don't need to look at it anymore. I know what it looks like from every angle. I know what it looks like filled with flowers, not filled with flowers. And so, I don't know, all of my paintings tend to be this combination of direct observation, some improvised from memory, or, you know, sometimes it's just a pattern that I've seen and I've liked and want to include. And then very often it's figurative. It's from some kind of informal photo that I've taken, just a candid snapshot to get the pose. Because, you know, if you know any 10-year-olds, you know they're not going to sit and hold a pose for you for 8 hours. So I take a lot of just, you know, goofy photos with my camera, with my phone, and use those as references.
This episode is sponsored by Trakel Art Supplies. Trakel Art Supplies started out by making high-quality brushes here in California. They maintain close relationships with the artists who use their products, which enables Trakel to serve their artists better. Greg Crayola Simpkins is a protein artist with Trakel. Turns out, Greg and his father helped Trakel build a whole new product line.
My dad was making my panels since I was like 18 and went through all the ups and downs of what materials we should be using. And my dad, he had a really good sense on what to do with those things. He was an engineer by career, but he was a carpenter for fun as a hobby at home. He always made stuff. And, you know, when Trakel wanted, we started talking to them about it. They're like, well, let's, you know, maybe your dad will show us how he makes it. And they sat down and he took them to his workshop, to his garage. He took Ian over there and he just showed him what he did. And Ian took and enhanced on what my dad does, or what my dad used to do. He doesn't make them anymore. He's gotten a little bit older. But Ian stepped up with my dad was doing even and made some really beautiful panels. And my dad's all excited to see what they've done. And I just thought to throw my dad a bone, just to throw his name on the back of every panel. Like, he used to put a branding mark on all my panels he made. So it said handcrafted by G.H. Simpkins, which is him. Everybody sees that and thinks it's me. I'm like, no, that's my dad. That's my dad's initials, George Henry Simpkins. And so Ian and Trakel, they put the little stamp for my dad on there just out of respect for him and just sitting down with them. So it was like a little thing I wanted them to honor my dad with.
So because Trakel loves Savvy Painter listeners so much, they are offering you an exclusive gift. From now through June 22nd, when you go to trakel.com, that's T-R-E-K-E-L-L.com, and you use the promo code SAVVYGIFT, you get a Trakel gift pack. So to claim yours, you just go to trakel.com. Again, that's T-R-E-K-E-L-L.com, and use promo code SAVVYGIFT on checkout. Do you paint in, I always imagine you working in gouache, but it sounded like from some of the, are you painting gouache or are you painting, what are you using?
If it's on paper, I'm using gouache and it's acrylic gouache. I don't know if you've ever used that.
Oh, I have one color that I can only get in acrylic gouache and yeah, I mix, yes. Yep.
Okay. I just I stumbled on that a few years ago and I've fallen in love with it. If I'm working on panels, it's acrylic, traditional tube acrylics.
Okay.
And that too has come out of the fact that I have a home studio. I used to paint in oils, but it's just not practical at home with kids and pets and yeah. So, and it's worked out okay. I have come to love acrylics for what they are and how fast you can work with them. And I don't know if I could go back to oils because I've kind of gotten used to the way acrylics handle and just the way you work with them as opposed to the way you paint with oils.
That's so interesting because, yeah, I used to be able to use it. I used to use acrylic and oil sort of almost interchangeably. Like it honestly didn't, I felt proficient enough in both that I could switch back and forth and not really be freaked out by anything, you know, not really go, you know, just be like, okay, this is acrylic, so it's going to behave this way.
Right.
But now I think I've just somehow just pushed into oils and it's suddenly so difficult for me now to go back to acrylics, mostly because I used to, without thinking, be able to adjust for the color difference when it dries. Like yeah. I could see it the way it was going to be when it was dried. So it never, it was like an automatic translation. And now I'm sitting there going, oh, what's this going to do? Or it's drying right. So fast that I can't, I guess I've slowed down a lot in how I paint because the acrylic is drying before I can get it on the canvas.
Yeah. Well, it's funny how you can't fight these materials, you know, no. You have to do what they do.
You have to translate. Yeah. Or.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually that's the beauty of acrylic wash is that it does not tend to shift color wise when okay. It's dry.
That's yeah. Cause I really haven't, honestly, I grabbed that color because I couldn't find it in traditional gouache. And I was just, and when I paint in gouache, I'm horrible. Like I mix it with everything. I mix gouache, you know, if I don't have the color, then I take watercolor and mix it with white. And, you know, like I will do what, like I beat it up, you know, there is no reverence for the medium. And so I'm like, oh, the color's not there. So I'm going to mix the acrylic in with the traditional gouache and see what happens. Okay. It seems to be all right.
That's great.
But, you know, all that's to say is I have no idea what the properties of acrylic gouache is because I just have that one color that gets mixed in with everything else.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I came across it. Susan Lichtman is a painter here in Boston. She teaches at Brandeis and she works with acrylic gouache.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think I saw it on a syllabus of hers and I thought, I don't know, I'm just going to try this. And it's, you know, relatively inexpensive compared to traditional gouache.
Yeah.
Which helps.
That's a plus.
It is a plus. You know, you talk about trying to pursue this as a vocation rather than a hobby and cost of materials is certainly an issue. So I came at it for those reasons, but I've really fallen in love with it as a medium. It's really nice.
How is it different from traditional gouache then? So you've mentioned that it doesn't change colors when it dries because traditional gouache will dry darker than it appears.
Right. Yeah. You don't get that as much of the acrylic gouache and it has some kind of acrylic binder so that when it's dry, it's not completely water resistant, but it's more water resistant than traditional gouache.
Okay.
So if you're doing a lot of layers, you're not going to pick up the layers underneath that you probably would if you're working in traditional gouache.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it keeps everything a little cleaner, less muddy.
Uh-huh.
I rework things all the time and I like to do it quickly. So it works for the way I like to work. You know, you're able to do that really quickly. And yeah, I don't know. That's actually the class I teach. I recommend using this acrylic wash and most people seem to really like it.
Cool. I'll have to pay more attention to it.
Yeah.
So I'd love to kind of drill down deep into like your actual painting practice and geek out on all of this stuff, if you don't mind. Because it's fun and I know I don't do it often enough because I'm always trying to like keep broad topics so that if somebody doesn't paint like you do, they're still going to be interested, but I don't care. So from what I've gathered, you have your studio at home, and then you pick up your easel and you drag it all over the house wherever you need it to be in order to finish a painting. Is that, or was it just that one painting?
No, that happens. That happens a lot.
How does your family feel about that?
They're good sports. They, you know, well, my son's a total ham, and the idea that pictures of him are hanging up in strangers' houses just thrills him.
I bet.
He has no issue with that. So they're great. My husband's very supportive. We joke, I have always had a kind of predilection for low-paying jobs. You know, when I was a lawyer, it was not a corporate lawyer. It was a criminal defense attorney, academic, painter. These are not
these are not like high-powered corporate jobs where you're going to be getting a company car. And
exactly. So to everyone in my family's credit, they acknowledge and support and embrace this. And I couldn't be luckier in that department.
I was just curious because my husband always teases me that he actually only has one small corner in the house that's still his that I haven't like slowly moved into or adopted as a painting surface or a podcasting surface or set up cameras or done something with. Like he still has this effectively a 3-foot by 4-foot desk in one corner that I have not touched yet. So he's always like, and it's in the middle of, there's no doors or anything for it, but he's always like, I'm going into my place because your place is actually the entire house.
I know. Well, I try to keep things at least at the end of the day, bring everything back into my little room. Yes. But yeah, no, they're pretty good. Every once in a while I whip out my phone to try to take a picture of something. They're like, could we please just eat? Or, could
could this not be a painting, Mom?
Exactly. But yeah, no, particularly when there's nobody home, I could be anywhere in the house painting.
Oh, yeah. Oh, when there's nobody home, I take over the entire house for sure.
Yeah.
So do you normally work on one painting at a time, or how do you?
Yeah, for the most part, I tend to be a fast painter.
Yeah.
I think people are either slow painters or fast painters. And I tend, at least the paintings that I'm most pleased with tend to be fairly fast efforts.
Do you sort of have a vision of what it's going to look like before you start, or are you an intuitive painter?
I think there's kind of a general thought, and I spend a lot of time, like if I'm doing something else, if I'm folding laundry or paying bills, I'm often thinking about a composition.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had times where something suddenly, I'm doing something completely unrelated and I think, oh, that needs to be blue. Mm-hmm. And, I'll write a little post-it note so that when I go back into the studio, I have the thought again. Otherwise it'll disappear.
Mm-hmm.
But I tend to improvise as I go along.
And do you do multiple versions of it? Like, I'm so curious because your paintings have such... Yeah, I imagined that you were a fast painter. It would have surprised me if you said you were a slow painter. But they're very well composed and have beautiful color harmony. So when you paint that quickly, I'm just kind of curious how you if you sort of are the type of person that's staring at things for a long time and then there's a flurry of activity.
Yeah, I think I start out pretty fast where I like to just sort of block it all in and get something. It's like what I'm always telling my students, just get something down.
Yeah.
And then you'll sit back and stare and think and fine tune and, maybe completely change colors, alter the composition. But I need something to react to first. So I sort of do this big rush flurry, get everything in, and then take a breath and think about it. I often revisit compositions. Like I just did a couple of weeks ago, I started on this piece of paper. It was like 11 by 14. And it was something on my dining room table, like a, still life based on a box of cereal and a bowl. And then I thought, well, I don't know, it feels like it should be bigger. And so I took another piece of paper the same size and I extended it a little.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just kept going and it turned into this sort of 3x3, 9 panel painting that now included figures and the rest of the table. And
oh, I remember that. You were posting that on. Yes, I have a vision of that in my head.
Yeah. And I finished that and I had a lot of fun, and it was collage and paint. And it's, you know, one of those good times where you're not really thinking about making a painting. You're just kind of playing. And and when I finished it, I thought, I'm not done with this. I like the idea and I could do this again. So now I'm sort of doing it again, you know, lots of changes and rethinking it, but I'm doing it again on one big panel. So that can happen. You know, if I feel like I haven't finished the idea or there's something else to, you know, some variation on a theme, then I'll go back to it. And then there are those ideas where, I don't know, you'd get it down and it's done and it doesn't thrill you, but you think, I'm just done. I'm done with the idea. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put it in the pile and move on. I don't know. Is that how you work?
What fascinates you and gets you excited to paint something? Do you see a thread in that?
Yeah. Well, I just love color. I don't draw very much because I can't stand to not have color, you know, or I'll do a drawing and then I get the gouache out or even crayons or whatever, because I am a total color addict. And it tends to be that way, you know, with everything, with things, you know, things that I've put in the house and textiles and fabric. So often I'll see some kind of color relationship that will inspire me, or patterns are another thing. Like, I'll see a tablecloth or, you know, something in the house, a pillow, and that will inspire me. Or, you know, as I said, with the painting of my son tying his cleats, it's just a pose or something somebody does that, I don't know, when you're a painter, you just, I think you're always looking for those kinds of things anyway. And, and when you sort of, like, when you see it, you know it.
Yeah. It's just a visceral response to either the composition or the color, it sounds like.
The
interaction.
Yeah, I think that's it. And, you know, you know it when you see it, and you just go from there.
I love
and
it.
Hope for the best.
Yeah, but it's very true. So what have been some of your biggest challenges since starting this endeavor?
Oh, boy. Well, I don't know. The answer is probably the same for everybody in terms of self-doubt. You know, even when you contacted me about interviewing me, I thought, really?
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I thought, okay, I don't know if I have anything interesting to say or why anyone would want to listen, but I think self-doubt is probably enemy number one.
What's really funny is you've been on my list for a long time. It's been in my head for like a long time that, like, oh, I need to contact Nancy. I need to get a hold of her.
Well, that's very sweet. And unexpected. I don't know. You know, you hope that people find what you do interesting, but there's a lot of self-doubt. I think that comes with all these sort of activities that you sit alone in a room and do, you know, whether you're a writer or an attorney or.
Well, there's not really any concrete, I don't want to say there's not a concrete thing with it, but it is so specifically about who you are and about, it's you and your vision. I mean, I think that's what makes art interesting. And that's also the scariest thing about it, is because, well, as a criminal defense attorney, you have a specific thing that you're supposed to do. You're supposed to defend this person who's been accused of a crime. And so that's very clear what your role in that situation is, right? And like, if you sell groceries, then, you know, you find groceries and you sell them to people, and there's not a lot of you in it. It's very kind of cut and dry. And with art, it's kind of like you're being asked to expose yourself to people in ways that are sometimes very uncomfortable, because it makes, I think, artists feel very vulnerable, and yet we sign up for it. So,
yeah. I think that's true. You know, and I think it goes back to what we were saying about Facebook and Instagram, that you put yourself out there.
Yeah.
And it's a little nerve-wracking because, and I think part of, you know, we do it because it is a solitary activity, and to put yourself out there, you're making connections and you feel a little less alone. But then there's always the self-doubt and, you know, worrying, well, what if it's not good enough? And, or what if this is my last good painting? You know, how will I?
What if this is the last painting I have in me?
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know. Everybody always seems to find a way to continue on.
What are some of the things you do when you're feeling that way to pull yourself out of it?
I tell you one thing I don't do. I have a temptation to always, when I'm in that mood, to sort of flip through my library of, you know, amazing art books and try to get inspiration from painters that I admire and have studied. And that sometimes can actually draw me into a bigger funk, I think, because you get back into that thing. Well, this has been done and by much better artists, and there's no room for anything new here. So instead of doing that, I try to just kind of sit down and just, again, try to just play a little rather than thinking, okay, I'm going to make a painting now. I just try to sit down, and even if it's not a subject that's, you know, particularly inspiring, if I just find something in the house or photograph and start drawing or painting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just sort of take the pressure off myself by saying that this isn't for anyone but me, and I'm just going to play around and experiment. Or sometimes, you know, I will take a book off the shelf, but I'll just do, you know, a study mm-hmm. of, you know, some masterwork. And so you feel like, you know, you're painting and you're practicing, but it's without any kind of added pressure of trying to make a painting.
Right. I love that you use the word play.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's supposed to be fun, right?
That's what they say. And it is. It really is. It is until that moment where you start like having those little mini freakouts or whatever. And I think all artists have it. And the question is, how long do you stay there? And what do you do to get yourself out of it? And I think play is one of the best ways to get yourself out.
Yeah. Yeah. That and clean up your studio, right?
That too.
Seems to be the other,
mm-hmm.
the other option.
Yeah. Unloading the dishwasher, like for yeah. some reason, like, and for me, I don't know why that is, but I think it's because it's already clean and it's just a matter of putting things in their place.
Yep. I agree. Well, that's the other thing about a home studio is there. If it's not working, there are lots of other things to be done.
Right. It's so strange how we go through these phases, I think, like, you know, unloading the dishwasher is my current one. And so I'm often disappointed when it's already unloaded, which I'm probably the only person in the country.
Yeah.
Like, oh, man, the dishwasher's already unloaded. Can I come over to your house and unload your dishwasher?
Anytime, entries.
So one thing I would love to know is, what are the habits that you have that you feel like contribute to the successes that you've had as an artist?
Hmm. Oh, that's a good question. I think that part of it is just focusing on sort of autobiographical subject matter. It's not really a technical habit that I think is the reason. I think it's more subject matter that people gravitate toward paintings that reveal a little bit about something about the person who painted them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
At least I know that's true for me. Like I don't know. The paintings that really grab my attention say something about the painter's life and vision of that life. Does that make sense? It sounds really cliche maybe, but.
No, it kind of, I mean, do you find that's true? I get to ask you this because you have a PhD in art history. But do you think that's
true? For what that's worth.
Do you think that's true in the art that you, like historical art as well? Or are you referring to contemporary artists or just across the board?
Yeah, no, I guess I am drawn to people like Fairfield Porter mm-hmm. or
Joan Brown is a painter that I love, whose work was definitely autobiographical. I think I am drawn to Alex Katz. You know, he's somebody who has spent a career painting his wife. And I never get tired of looking at those paintings, you know, because you feel like not only are you seeing the people, but you're clearly seeing how the artist feels about those people. Mm. You know, the same with Fairfield Porter, too, although, again, this sort of schism between art history and art, you know, as an art historian, I'm familiar with his family. Life wasn't always peaches and cream. But when you look at his paintings, the amount of just hours alone that he devoted to painting his domestic life clearly shows a certain level of devotion and passion for it.
Right. I wonder if that's just another, not just, if that's another way of looking at that, you know, how we started this conversation, the idea that what's unique about us as an artist is our own experiences. And so the content and the motifs that you choose to paint are that and are showing who you, Nancy, are as both an artist and a human being.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, I think that is a byproduct, too, of, again, this kind of later in life entry into the field, because I don't know, I spent so much time painting things that didn't exist in my life 20 years ago. So maybe it all came together at a good time. And the confluence of events was right, because what I'm interested in painting, it's, you know, are things that just, I don't know what I would have painted if I was painting full time in my 20s or 30s.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's different. It changes.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you could own a piece of art by any living artist, what would it be or whose?
Oh, boy.
Always, every single time I always get that groan, that, oh.
I know. Well, because my house would be full of, I mean, I have tried to purchase as many things from friends that paint that I love, but yeah, there aren't enough walls to cover everybody that I really admire. One of my favorite contemporary painters is Aubrey Leventhal.
I don't know her.
She's a Philadelphia painter. Again, I would put her in this sort of autobiographical camp. You're really seeing, I feel like I know her through her paintings. So she's someone I would love. I would love a painting by, there's a Scottish artist, Elizabeth Blackadder, who's, I believe, in her late 80s or early 90s. And I'm a huge fan of her work. That would be amazing to have something by Blackadder in my house. Oh, boy. So there are just so many. John Boker, I mentioned, Australian artist. I love his work. There's so many. That's, I think, one of the great things about Facebook and Instagram, too. You just suddenly the whole world opens up, and I've become friends with and followers of so many painters.
Yes.
Yeah, there aren't enough walls. I don't know. Chantal Joffe, too, the British painter. I love her work. Oh, boy. I should have, I thought going into this, Antrese, that I should have prepared a list of.
You can send it to me. I'm sure people will love that.
Yes, I would do that. I'll do that.
I would love it.
Because I know I've left lots of people out, and I just, it's a very long list. So I'm going to send it to you, and you can tack it on. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so excited. Awesome. Well, Nancy, thank you so much for talking with me. And I have really enjoyed getting to know you a little bit and seeing you in person and hearing your thoughts on painting. I really appreciate the time you've taken to talk with me.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Thank you again to Nancy for taking the time to share her experiences with us. Go to savvypainter.com for show notes on this episode and to see Nancy's paintings. And while you're there, make sure you don't miss an episode of the podcast. Sign up for show updates and free guides at savvypainter.com. One more thing I want to let you know. This year, you can expect a lot more workshops from Savvy Painter. If you are an artist who struggles with getting painting time in or feels like you're always busy but never really moving forward with your art, then my workshops just might interest you. Past workshops include Mindset Mastery, a 5-week online workshop to help you get past the roadblocks that keep you from painting. In it, we tackle the inner critic, fears of artists, and setting yourself up for a successful creative day. The workshop, How to Develop a Relationship with the Right Gallery, helped several artists find the right gallery and show their work. So if this is something that interests you, you can go to savvypainter.com/workshop and get on the email list. This is separate from the main list that tells you when a new episode comes out. This is just for the workshop, so you don't get quite as many emails, but when you do, there's always something really good happening. Sign up now and get a downloadable PDF with case studies that tell you exactly how three artists pushed through barriers that were getting in the way of their studio time. You can, for example, learn how Rhonda went from not wanting to call herself an artist to getting her very first solo show. Also, listen to an introverted artist describe how she built her confidence and then spoke in front of an audience of her peers. And you can discover the tools that Samantha used to take back her power after a decade of believing that she had no, I'm putting air quotes there, she had no talent. So again, go to savvypainter.com/workshop to reserve your place on the list. When you sign up, you get that downloadable case studies that I mentioned, but more importantly, you get exclusive invites to upcoming workshops. Most of the time when I launch a new program, it sells out before I ever announce it publicly. So reserve your spot now at savvypainter.com/workshop. Until next week, this is Antrese Wood with the Savvy Painter Podcast. Thank you so much for listening.